things were no different in war, when every postchaise was commandeered as a lonely detachment. Beyond every bend, in the track lurked trouble, or friction, as Clausewitz puts it. An unexpected rockfall, storm damage after the autumn gales, a mule carcass at the edge of the path, and this battle also became more intricate and more elaborate. One cannot seek out one's preferred theatre of war, as one might choose a product from a range of samples, Clausewitz reminds us. Might the same not be said of the terrain to be traversed? One does not always have a selection of routes to choose from. What if there is only one? And what if the gloom of dusk and inclement weather come into play? To illustrate what we might understand as friction in war, Clausewitz offers the civilian example of a traveller under the dark of night. Let's picture a traveller who imagines he will easily cover the remaining two stations of his day's journey by evening. A mere 4 to 5 hours with post horses on the road, a doddle. But when he reaches the penultimate station, there is no horse, or only a very poor one. Then he encounters a mountainous terrain, damaged roads, and meanwhile, the twilight gives way to pitch black. He is relieved when, after many hardships, he reaches the next station and finds himself some austere accommodation for the night. It's not unlike wartime life. No sooner have you got around one hindrance than you are halted again by another spanner in the works. Particularly ominous are circumstances in which the soil and weather form a vicious alliance. Mud is the worst enemy of the horse-drawn vehicle. Woe to the coachman who fails to see it coming, as Pierre de Marivaux wrote in 1714. The conversation about love was very heated, while, as a result of carelessness, the coachman, having downed a stoneware bottle behind our backs, proceeded to drive our wayward horses headlong into thick mire, into which the poor animals sank deeply, along with the wheels of our heavy carriage, which became thoroughly stuck. Noticing the horses had ground to a halt, the drivers went at them with many a gee-up and a crack of the whip, while the horses strained and pulled, sinking yet deeper the more they struggled. The coachmen shouted their thirsty throats hoarse, lashing at the beasts like savages, in vain, for the horses were already short of breath. Cursing the phaeton, which hadn't budged a fraction, we got out, while the coachmen redoubled their blows and curses. But not even the Bastille stands as firmly on its foundations as our wheels in this accursed mud. In The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, this same substance brings a sticky end to an unexpected encounter between two mounted men, the man-midwife, Dr. Slop, and the servant, Obadiah, on the muddiest stretch of a treacherous track not far from Shandy Hall, which leaves Dr. Slop stranded, with the broadest part of him sunk about 12 inches deep into the mire. What was it Werner Sombart wrote in his Economic History of Germany in the 19th century? Endless reports of carts getting bogged down, including postal workers asphyxiating in the mire. Sombart did not live to hear the accounts of the Wehrmacht facing their first tribulations in Russia in September 1941, pitted against the enemy alliance of soil and weather. He died in May of that year. But he would not have been surprised. No conqueror can retain a firm grip in the face of the resistance of the elements, Sombart would have said. Indeed, he might have added that law and order itself, the nomos of the earth, would one day sink into the mire, parodying his friend Carl Schmitt, the author of such a work. A Country Doctor. Besides the historic world figures like Bonaparte and his many imitators, as well as the revolutionaries, poets, and scholars so revered by the 19th century, not to mention the balloonists, it is easy to overlook the everyday heroes. With time, individuals are given the credit they're due. We do justice to the engineers, the architects of steel bridges and glass palaces, when we say that they were the true heroes of the 19th century. At a certain point, we also rediscovered the great doctors, the explorers and innovators, the heroes and heroines of humanity. Then, there are the philosophers, the inventors of the isms of the 20th century, and those who prophesied their coming. But there is still one figure who sits in his modest practice, listening out for the sound of the night bell, awaiting recognition by posterity. And indeed, it was the literature of 19th and 20th centuries, the stories and novels of the likes of Honoré de Balzac, Gustave Flaubert, and Franz Kafka, that immortalized this unsung hero. The country doctor's was a thoroughly equestrian, as it were, centurion existence. Nobody besides the cavalry depended on his horse as much as he. If he drove instead of riding, he used the lightest and most maneuverable vehicle the market had to offer. He waived prestige in favor of speed and agility. Instead of a team of two or even four horses, which his modest fees would not allow, he opted for a one-horse setup. The rural doctor was not only a contemporary Hippocrates, whose Greek name horse tamer says it all, he was also a roaming missionary of enlightenment in the provinces. Balzac presented him as a counterfigure to a cavalry officer who has taken part in every single battle against Napoleon, in Italy, Egypt, and Russia, through to the last campaign in France, while the country doctor waged his long, patient campaign against the ignorance and lethargy of the rural population. Kafka depicts the rural physician as a wretched soul, vexed by anxiety, plagued by images of unbridled power, the lecherous and aggressive groom, the fleshy horses, the mighty creatures with powerful flanks, the maiden Rosa, who is initially willing, but who then flees in fright. Reaching his destination, the doctor is himself stripped and laid down in the patient's bed to become the remedy, lying alongside the sick man's terrible festering wound, while, up above, sway shadowy horses' heads. When the doctor finally escapes, making as fast a getaway as he can, the straps trail loose, one horse barely attached to the other, the carriage wandering about behind. With aspects of Heinrich von Kleist's novella, Michael Kohlhaas, peeking through the cracks in the text, the doctor is every bit the lost soul. Naked, exposed to the frost of this unhappiest of ages, with an earthly carriage, unearthly horses, an embodiment of all fatal misfortunes that can befall a country doctor and a keeper of horses on this dark earth. Perhaps literature's most famous country doctor is Charles Bovary. Around the middle of the 19th century, he practices his humble art in the small villages near Rouen, Normandy. Like all men of his standing, he is constantly on the go. Charles, in rain and snow, rode along the country lanes. His wife dreams of a groom, but as he cannot afford one, he saddles up the horse and looks after it himself. Occasionally he also makes use of a lightweight carriage, which he bought for his young wife, a second-hand gig, which, with new lamps and splashboards in mottled leather, looked almost like a tilbury. With Charles at the reins, this gig makes just as unfortunate an impression as anything the hapless soul touches. Charles, perched on the very edge of the seat, was driving with his arms held wide, and the little horse was ambling along between the shafts, which were rather too big for him. The loose reins were slapping on his rump, sopping in a frothy sweat, and the box tied on behind kept banging about. The doctor's name says it all. Does Bovary not echo Bovis, the ox? He is the epitome of inelegance. To emphasize his clumsy awkwardness, Flaubert contrasts him with the sophisticated men who dance as outrageously as they ride, laughing with cigars in their mouths. It is one of these dashing rascals who tempts Emma into her first fling, during a horseback ride for two, which offers the lady a sensual thrill from the outset. Her head slightly bowed, she yielded to the rocking motion of the saddle. Just before the two riders, Emma and Rodolphe, pass beyond the edge of the forest, an invisible line which seems to divide good morals from sin like light from dark, we read, "The horses were blowing, the saddle leather was creaking." The interplay of light and sounds evoking an atmosphere full of colors, noises, movement, and smells, is the signal for something inevitable that can be delayed, but can no longer be held back entirely. Again, as the scene draws to an end towards the evening, the horses play a pivotal role. Entering Yonville, she pranced her horse on the cobbled street. Eyes examined her from the windows. Besides the slights to his honor as a husband, to which Bovary is oblivious, the novel also charts the slights to his social and professional standing. The worst defeat suffered by the doctor, little more than a nursing attendant, whose meager training has taught him only the rudiments of the medical arts, is an incident which occurs when he attempts to cure Hippolyte, the ostler at the local inn, of his club foot. While the groom was hitherto quite cheerful about his equinus, actually as large as a horse's hoof, with rough skin, stiff tendons, huge toes, and black nails just like the rivets on a horseshoe, and galloped about like a stag. Nevertheless, now that science had descended on the village, represented by the pharmacist, Homais, it had been declared that he was suffering and needed to be cured. The surgery, cutting the Achilles tendon, followed by treatment in a homemade stretching apparatus, ends disastrously. In the allegorical web woven by Flaubert at this point, almost exactly halfway through the novel, and shortly after the climax of Emma's affair with Rodolphe, the fatal snip made by the doctor is like a spark in the tinder. It was a British country doctor, specifically a vet with a practice in Ireland, who in the 1880s invented the pneumatic tire for the second time, and this time successfully. John Boyd Dunlop was a Scottish veterinary surgeon who was a friend of Queen Victoria. Tired of the discomfort of driving on unmade roads, he experimented with air-filled pneumatic tires and developed a usable bicycle tire, which was launched to the public in 1887. 2 years later, Willie Hume, the captain of the Belfast Cruisers Cycling Club, won a series of bicycle races in Ireland and England on a bike equipped with Dunlop's tires. This was the start of the bicycle's rapid, triumphal march as the racehorse of the poor. But thanks to Dunlop's invention, country doctors were also able to reach their patients more quickly and more safely than before. A few years later, the country doctor would also become one of the first intensive users of the fledgling automobile. In this profession, speed is not a luxury, but a vital necessity. It is speed that saves lives. From one incident to another. Doctors traveling by horseback or by carriage would often be called out to accidents involving other riders or coachmen. Horses are jumpy animals, easily spooked and quick to yield to their natural flight reflex. Once one bolts, it is no easy matter to catch it and calm it down again. Of course, Hippolytus, the son of Theseus, and Hippolyta, the Amazon, knows a thing or two about horses, as his name suggests. He is blessed in this regard from his mother's side. As Queen of the Amazons, she would hardly have qualified for the job without some skill in the saddle. Yet, for all his flair as a charioteer, he falls victim to a classic traffic accident, behind which lurk the usual Olympian intrigues. Love, hate, and revenge all conspire, and the story ends with Poseidon sending an enormous sea monster to scare the horses pulling Hippolytus's carriage, causing them to bolt. The chariot crashes into an olive tree. Its passenger is killed. The bolting horse is the terror of all horsemen, a nightmare for anyone who travels in a carriage. But it is not the horse in isolation that made travel so risky before the age of mechanized transport. Other factors played a part. Bad roads, bad weather, darkness, the laziness and drunkenness of the personnel, including the driver. Finally, the carriage itself. If the brakes are not applied properly, the carriage wobbles and overturns, and once it's landed in the mud, it's as good as stuck. The accident caused by bolting horses and an overturned, shattered carriage has been a topos of travel literature since its beginnings in the Renaissance. A famous engraving in Ulrich von Rickenthal's 15th century Chronicle of the Council of Constance shows an upturned carriage at Alburg in 1414. It is that of Antipope John the 23rd, fleeing from the Council of Constance, where he had been deposed. The widespread fascination with the accident, captured in this historical snapshot, although it possibly had no real basis in fact, reflects a morbid curiosity that continues to this day. No anthology of travel writing, no cultural history exhibition on the age of horse-drawn carriages in Germany, is complete without a passing mention of George Christoph Lichtenberg's satire on the dangers of traveling, or Karl Immermann's 1821 satirical account of an accident. Thomas de Quincey's account of an imaginary collision between two horse-drawn vehicles, a heavy stagecoach and a lightweight gig, on the highway at night is, for all its rhetorical bombast, a masterpiece of literary suspense. Especially popular were the accounts of grisly accidents and miraculous escapes, which filled 18th-century almanacs and collections of anecdotes. One example is the breathtaking description in the 1799 edition of the Handbook for Horse Lovers, Riders, Breeders, Veterinary Surgeons, and Supervisors of Large Stables. Taschenbuch für Pferdeliebhaber, Reiter, Pferdesitter, Pferdearzt und Vorgesetzter großer Marsteller, an annual publication issued by the German publisher Cotta. An Englishman by the name of Luthbert Lambert of Newcastle was riding over Sanford's Stone Bridge, when upon this bridge he wished to make an about turn, causing his horse to come to a halt so abruptly that the swift and sensitive horse suddenly reared up into the air, and the very next moment leaped over the railing of the bridge into the river below. A low-lying branch of an ash tree, hanging with good fortune so close to the bridge, saved this rider from death. He clung firmly to this same branch and remained hanging there until some passers-by delivered him from this uncomfortable and indeed fearsome position. The horse, which plummeted with all its might onto the riverbed some 20 foot below, lay in the place where it had died. In addition to the literary archives, we also have a long history of chronicling horse riders coming a cropper in illustrated form, with the most recent and most spectacular additions to the genre available on YouTube, Plate 9. The historical forerunner to these pictures and videos was a sort of European image gallery of every conceivable kind of accident involving a horse, a carriage, or a wagon, which was the tradition of ex-voto paintings. The catalogue of horrors and miracles spans the same time frame as this book. The long swan song of the age of the horse, from the end of the 18th to the mid-20th century. Browsing through its images, we might take a pilgrimage to a famous Catholic site such as Altötting, or consult an ethnographic collection such as that at Hellbrunn Palace, Salzburg. In the small votive illustrations expressing prayers and giving thanks, people's beliefs give form and color to every imaginable incident involving horses and intercessions by Mary and the competent saints. An overturned carriage, the coachman trampled, the horses fled. A frantic horse, bolting with a carriage still attached, the coachman under the wheel, his cap flung to the ground in the corner of the picture. Two draft horses that have jumped over a wall, smashing the wagon and injuring the driver. Three horses in a stable, a stable boy lying by the hind legs of one, two men rushing over in horror. A horse and coachman lying on their backs, their carriage overturned and in pieces. A carriage, with its driver fallen into a ravine, the horse standing at the edge of the cliff. A collision between a wagon and a carriage, the driver hurled to the ground, the injured horse trying to break free. A collision between a horse-drawn cart and a motorcycle, the driver is on the ground, the injured horse is on its knees. Since 1970, when the annual death toll on the roads in the Federal Republic of Germany reached almost 20,000, there have been intensive efforts to improve traffic safety and reduce the harm caused by collisions, resulting in considerable improvements to accident statistics. Similar efforts were made with regard to horse-drawn traffic some 200 years earlier. As in our time, it was not merely a matter of the regulation and control of the traffic. It also involved technical improvements to the two main components of the locomotor system. In our case, the car and its engine. In those days, The Carriage and the Horse. First, the carriage. In 1756, a French handbook for stable masters presented the allegedly untippable Berlin model. Johann Pope's History of Inventions focuses on efforts to improve vehicle safety, higher wheels, broader axles, greater agility, and solidity of the parts, carried out a quarter of a century earlier. Any industrious cartwright can improve a carriage. But how does one improve the nature of a draft animal? How does one help a horse to keep its nerve? Or, if it loses it and bolts, how does one bring it to a halt? In 1802, J.G. Herklotz launched his Description of a Machine that Prevents Riding and Carriage Horses from Bolting. 3 years later, J. Rehm recommends 2 failsafe, tried and tested means of protecting against danger in the event of runaway horses. Pope's History of Inventions is systematic in its approach and distinguishes between 3 procedures that might prevent horses from bolting, or mitigate the consequences when they do. These are 1. A full braking system. 2. The separation of the horses from the carriage. 3. Rapidly covering the eyes of the frenzied beasts. A residual risk remains, of course, in every event. After all, you can't simply switch off an oat-powered engine like you can a petrol engine. The comic theater of the 19th century had audiences in stitches, laughing at all the overturned coaches and carriages that were constantly toppling over on the boardwalks and boulevards. Who knew who the next victim would be, found head over heels in the most embarrassing and laughable confusion of limbs and clothing? The horror of public indignity found a beloved home in the anarchy of the stage. The upturned carriage unleashed social chaos and satirical laughter that brought the stage to life. The spotlight shone on what, behind the curtains, was sending the city and country reeling. In the early 1850s, when Flaubert was working on Madame Bovary, hardly a year passed without a new play about Jean the Postman, or Jean the Coachman, hitting the stages of Paris and the provinces. Whether it was vaudeville, a one-act operetta, or a five-act play. Just as in the following century, the movies indulged in a never-ending romance with the motor car. So in the 19th century, the theater flirted endlessly with the horse-drawn carriage, especially in popular musical theater such as operetta, vaudeville, and variety shows. The 20th century arts critic Siegfried Krakauer once commented that the music of Philippe Musard reminded him of an old Napoleon film where the emperor was riding in a carriage to a remote battlefield, surrounded by a swarm of rushing mounted orderlies and messengers, all giving the impression that the emperor was racing through the world at tremendous speed. Musard's balls must have been dynamic events with no less power. Returning to Flaubert, it is the theatre, albeit a more serious kind of performance, the opera Lucia di Lammermoor, that occasions a fatal reunion of Emma Bovary and the apprentice Leon, triggering similarly dynamic events which reach their climax 2 days after the evening at the theatre during an aimless 6-hour carriage ride through Rouen and the surrounding countryside. "It's what people do in Paris," Leon comments as he calls for a cab. In rural France, on the other hand, the unusual spectacle attracted the suspicious attention of the locals. Down by the harbour, in among the wagons and the great barrels, and in the streets on every corner, the bourgeois gaped in amazement at this extraordinary thing appearing in a provincial town. A carriage with its blinds shut, coming into view like this over and over again, as secret as the grave, and shuddering along like a ship at sea. Unlike the vaudeville librettist, the author of Madame Bovary could not allow the coach, in which Emma surrenders to her lover, to overturn and burst open to reveal the events unfolding within the hidden, moving space. The readers of the novel write the continuation of the story for themselves, filling in the vacuum of what is left unsaid within the coach, which orbits like a somber moon through the space between the town and the country. "As secret as a grave," writes Flaubert, "and shuddering like a ship. The coach is a cell. It is a cavern, and a vessel that bobs about getting bumped and bruised, and yet is oblivious to its surroundings. An absolute interior that exudes an atmosphere both claustrophobic and erotically intimate. A closed carriage, writes Mario Praz, was like the cozy corner of a drawing room, only the chests and luxurious divans had been shifted outside. Flaubert leaves his parlor firmly closed off, describing only the orbit of the black monade and reminding the reader of the two sweaty horses and the weary coachman, half insane from thirst, who are facilitating the endless circulation of this strange space capsule. The Sound of the Country. A familiar topos of cultural criticism is the image of the city as a raucous monster, a sleepless Moloch, surrounded day and night by noise. The countryside, on the other hand, is characterized as a blissful kingdom of silence. The city is as loud and shrill as a saw. The country is either silent or murmurs softly like a gentle rain. The only thing that's true about such stereotypes is the differentiation of the contrasting soundscapes. The world of the city is indeed typified by an orchestra of mechanical noises, but the clatter of horses' hooves and cartwheels is also at home here, the screech of metal against metal or clanging on cobblestones. But the sound space of the country is most certainly not limited to the rustle of the wind, birdsong, and the grunts and snorts of farm animals. The countryside has its own mechanical sound corpus. The cacophony of hammering, pounding, mowing, sawing, and milling. Workers all busy eliciting specific sounds from the plants and metals of the earth, from their houses, tools, and everyday objects. When a body makes a sound, writes Hegel, it is, so to speak, mechanical light. It touches us, because tone is itself inwardness and subjectivity. It speaks to the inner soul. In an insightful study of the folk songs associated with working on the land, economist Karl Buescher manages to trace the source of rhythms and melodies back to the sounds of physical labor. When a maid scrubs the floor, the forwards and backwards motion of the scrubbing brush emits tones of varying strength. Similarly, when mowing the grass, the backswing and swish of the scythe resounds with tones of varying strength and length. Hammering the hoop of a barrel into place with blows of varying intensity, the cooper also creates a kind of melody, while the butcher's boy, with the chop of his cleaver, summons up an entire drum march. What Buescher doesn't mention is the lovely resonance of the whetstone grinding and knocking on metal that rings out when one sharpens a scythe or sickle, a sound that would have been heard in all rural areas across Central Europe until the mid-20th century. Against the constant murmur of the rural backing track, we hear the sometimes quiet, sometimes relatively loud contribution of a combination of various or clearly audible instruments. For the Agricultural Symphony Orchestra, there was no need to wait until the first plows were pulled across the fields by steam engines, followed a few decades later by tractors, or until the first combine harvesters were dragged, clattering by some 30 horses across the endless wheat fields of the Midwest. Even the time of carriages brought a particular song of sighs and groans to the country. The language used by Flaubert as he captures the motion of the lover's fiacre in the famous scene simultaneously evokes the rhythm and sounds of heavy machinery. And the big engine began to move. The vehicle set off again. Gathering speed on the hill, she drove at full gallop, trotted gently along. She rolled along very peacefully, with the unpolished straps cracking in the heat. Like the windmill, the ship, and the railway, the horse-drawn coach, with its large wooden resonating body and its many moving parts, is a musical instrument of a particular size and quality. Its wooden structures are constantly chafing against iron, leather, and other wooden parts. The box is constantly rising and falling, taking air in and out with a sigh and a hiss. Ludwig Born recorded the many sounds associated with a carriage filling with air. Groaning, sighing, moaning, clattering, grunting, purring, rattling, hissing, mewing, barking, growling, chattering, squawking, growling, jangling, whistling, murmuring, sobbing, singing, grumbling, and sulking. Even if the satirist exaggerates, the sound history of past centuries forms a musical corpus dedicated to a very different set of composers from those of classical music. The anonymous builders of carriages, carts, windmills, and cranes. The stone beaters hammering down the cobblestones of squares and bridges. And we certainly mustn't forget the bell makers. In one of the most beautiful books on French cultural history, Alain Corbin reconstructs the sound space of the bell, describing the fullness of its chime, a resonance which rippled through every corner of pre-revolutionary France. "It is not easy," writes Corbin, "to picture the emotional power wielded by bells at the end of the old regime. Despite the cultural associations of city belfries, such as London's Oranges and Lemons, say the bells of St. Clemens, the staggering power of the chiming bells was by no means a purely urban phenomenon. On the contrary, abbeys covered the verdant wildernesses with networks of rings, although it is hard for us to gauge how far their sound carried. The abbeys of Normandy were capable of achieving a particularly high volume of sound. Indeed, the most significant changes to the auditory landscape and the most acute sense of loss and deprivation probably occurred in the Normandy countryside between the 18th and the 19th centuries. On the eve of the Revolution, 13 bells used to ring out on days of religious festivals in the small town of Saint-Pierre-sur-Dive. Some episcopal towns could likewise produce a sound disproportionate to the size of their populations. Wilhelm Heinrich Riehl, a writer and cultural historian who originally intended to become a parish priest, recalls in his Cultural Studies from Three Centuries that another form of music that rang out from the church towers was that of the tower watchmen or trumpeters. "In many Protestant towns and villages," writes Riehl, "until recent times, it was customary for a horn player to play a chorale every morning and evening, and even at midday. The workers in the fields would halt their ploughs for a moment when the solemn tones rang out through the quiet of the morning landscape. In the workshops, all was still for a few minutes. It was through such music that everyone was granted spiritual and artistic consecration for at least a few moments each day." In addition to the bells and choral song of the churches, and in addition to the woodwind instrumentation of the carriages, boats, and mills, the soundscape of the rural world had a third component. This was the percussion of the blacksmith, the drummer of the countryside, the rhythm section of the village big band. The forge has long been considered the birthplace of the Western perception of the mathematics of music. Pythagoras, it is said, passed by the smithy one day and was astonished to notice that the sound of the hammers rang out at pure intervals of fourths, fifths, and octaves. He ascertained that the only difference among the hammers was their weight, and found that their weights were related in the ratios 4-3, 3-2, and 2-1. The story goes on that Pythagoras hung weights corresponding to these hammers from equally long strings, and found, on plucking them, that the same intervals were produced. Despite the physical impossibilities of this legend, there is something in it, argues the classical scholar Walter Burkert, something that refers back to the Idaean dactyls, the mythical blacksmiths associated with Orpheus, who were regarded as the inventors of music. Their story brings to light the secret of the magical music which was discovered by the mythical blacksmiths. The soft fabric of bell ringing, as Corbin put it, may have been thinner and more threadbare since the Revolution. But who else has described the vast change to the rural world since the rhythmic hammering of the blacksmith fell silent? The village forge gave the day its beat, its melody. It may have been a less festive and emotional form of music than that of the bells, less closely associated with the village's celebrations and their grief, but it was nevertheless an integral part of daily life. The ever-present clang of hammers on the anvil was an acoustic sign of industriousness, the surest sign of life of the organism that is the village. The forge was the heart of the local community of producers and suppliers. This was where its tools were made, where its horses were shod. In 1888, just as the first automobiles were coming into the world. Arnold Böcklin painted Centaur at the Village Blacksmith Shop, Plate 4. A bearded centaur, light brown with flecks of white, has trotted into the village smithy and presents his right front hoof to the blacksmith, as if to say, "Here, master, your help is needed." It is not out of the question that Böcklin, who had a passion for flying machines, was also observing the increasing mechanization of land transport as he transformed the old era of horseshoes and smithies into the realm of myth. Whatever his intention, with his humorously cryptic image of the centaur stopping by the village forge, he succeeded in creating one of the most charming icons of a rural world, a world which, like the century, was coming to an end. It was not the first time that Böcklin had attempted to convey this creature, half-man, half-horse. In 1873, he painted Battle of the Centaurs, followed 5 years later by a peaceful portrait of a centaur sitting quietly beside a lake, not troubling the water. In Battle of the Centaurs, Plate 1, he presents his unmistakable response to the much-debated question, among classicists, of the nature of centaurian sexuality. Incidentally, with this picture he remains true to a very classical mythology, which presents the centaur as a belligerent and quarrelsome creature. Again, he respected tradition when in 1898 he painted Nessus and Deianira as a scene of sexual violence with fatal consequences for all three protagonists. How different, then, is the portrayal in Centaur at the Village Blacksmith's Shop? Here, we have a perfectly civilized customer who has politely trotted in to give instructions to the blacksmith. The notorious rascal of mythology appears here as a peaceful visitor to the village, a customer in need of the services of the capable craftsman. The village women at the edge of the scene look on inquisitively, while the blacksmith seems to be assessing the scale of the damage, wrote Petr Kipov, like a car mechanic au vent la lettre. As we consider this scene, at every moment we expect to hear the first blow of the hammer as the whole village rouses from its slumber. Now creaking and rumbling, a carriage might roll up, the bells begin to ring, and the rural orchestra stirs into life. Finally, all that remains is for the sparrows to swoop in, eagerly awaiting the centaur's offerings. Incidentally, with his robust figure, Böcklin's centaur also fits perfectly into this rustic environment. In his lower half, he's a sturdy farm horse. The countryside is a world apart from the aristocracy of the slender racehorse. Riding West. I don't get on a horse unless they pay me. John Wayne. Cowboys and Indians. The riderless and bridleless horse that staggered through the main street of Fort Lincoln was clearly drunk. The bay stallion was single-mindedly rummaging through garbage cans before casually kicking them over. If he found the contents to his taste, he would gleefully wallow in the pickings before carrying on, covered in coffee grounds and potato skins. In the evening, he would pop in to see the soldiers, and they would share a beer or two with him. Then he'd amble on over to the officers' mess to have a drink with them too. Perhaps even a drop of the harder stuff. There was no doubt about it. The old boy was a boozer. But no one thought of prescribing cold turkey or hitching him up to a cart. It was forbidden to ride the old chap. He was a war hero, and since 1878 had borne the title of Second Commanding Officer. The name of this stallion with a taste for liquor was Comanche. He was the only non-Native American survivor of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, later known as Custer's Last Stand. The former owner of the veteran stallion was an Irishman by birth, Miles Keogh. As courageous and as fond of a tipple as his horse, he left home early and emigrated to America, where he climbed the ranks to cavalry officer. As a regimental commander under Lieutenant Colonel Custer, he rode his stallion into the battle of the 25th of June, 1876, where he was killed, along with his leader and his entire regiment. When the battle was over, the field at Little Bighorn was littered with human and animal corpses. In the words of one historian, the horse cavalry was reduced to a horse cavalry, and Comanche, with several bleeding wounds, was the only creature still standing. Miraculously, the gravely injured animal was rescued and, as a precious living testimony, was transported back to Fort Lincoln, the garrison from which Custer's regiment had set off some weeks before. The only obligation incumbent on this animal henceforth was to participate in the annual commemorative parade on the anniversary of the battle, which passed imperceptibly from the narrative of history into the realm of myth. The American Indian Wars, which came to a bloody climax at Little Bighorn and a cruel end at the Massacre of Wounded Knee, 1890, began in the 17th century and increased in violence and intensity throughout the 19th as the result of the brutal government policies towards native inhabitants and the gradual shift of the frontier of settled population westwards beyond the Mississippi. It was no coincidence that its last and bloodiest phase was in the period following the Civil War. Wars do not end on the date of the ceasefire or at the moment of surrender. They move underground, shoved along to other theaters of war, until the lethal energy is finally spent. When, after the Homestead Act of 1862, and reinforced by the end of the Civil War in 1865, ever greater masses of settlers poured into the Great Plains and pushed the frontier of conquest westwards, this led to an escalation of conflict with the tribes already living there, including the Sioux, Cheyenne, Kiowa, Blackfoot, Crow, Arapaho, and others. To protect the settlers, the federal government deployed a cavalry regiment made up of former members of the armies of both sides in the Civil War. The internecine conflict among the white settlers spawned a bitter war with the Native Americans, lasting over two decades. The radicalism that characterized the Civil War in its final phase was also felt in the subsequent racial war. But unlike the fighting in the previous conflict, this one was fought almost exclusively on horseback. The American cavalry found a well-matched foe in the tribal horseback warriors of the Great Plains. Or, to be more precise, the warring Native American horsemen found an evenly matched foe in the cavalry of the reunified country. For a long time, the uniformed riders had been hopelessly inferior to their native counterparts, both in agility on the field and in battle tactics and shooting technique. During the Civil War, both sides, Union and Confederate, had vastly refined their cavalry tactics and improved their weaponry. The militaries had swapped their heavy horses for more agile and tougher Mustangs. Now they rode faster, fought more flexibly, and with their new handguns, they shot more quickly and hit their targets better. The cavalry had successfully modernized and was now taking part in an archaic war, led by their opponents in the style of the Mongols and Saracens centuries before. The American Civil War, 1861 to 1865, occupies a special position in the history of the waning era of the horse, being at once an integral part of it, but looking beyond it. On one hand, the infantry's improved firepower and accuracy since the middle of the century robbed the cavalry of their status as the most powerful and decisive offensive weapon, a reputation they had still been able to claim for four or five decades after the Napoleonic Wars. Large, soft targets like horses and men are as good as useless against automatic, rapid-fire weapons. The flamboyance of cavalry shock tactics lost their value on the modern battlefield. 1.5 million dead horses and mules, compared to 600,000 human casualties in a five-year conflict, says a lot about the nature of this war. Its prelude was also significant in this respect. The bombardment of Fort Sumter on the 12th of April, 1861, which opened the floodgates to spiraling military engagement, claimed just one victim after 33 hours, a horse. As in most armies of the world, in the American Civil War, the cavalry had three core tasks to fulfill. The first was in reconnaissance and securing communications lines. The second was actual combat use as a high-speed shock weapon. And the third was surprise attacks behind enemy lines and sabotage. For all the success that the cavalry could claim on the battlefield in the Civil War, it was this second task, the offensive role in combat, that became problematic, thanks to improved infantry weapons, namely the breech loader with its increased rate of fire, and thanks to the supporting field artillery. Firing with all barrels blazing, the use of cavalry became more difficult and more expensive. In the days when it was cavalry fighting cavalry, their skirmishers were balanced. But if they were up against well-equipped infantry, it was quite a different matter. The unmounted infantry, for long historical periods the classic prey of the cavalry, so easily trampled and hacked down if they could not flee in time, had suddenly become a dangerous predator. Their firepower had increased, and therefore so had their security and their self-confidence. This required a change in tactics to be adopted by the warring sides of the American Civil War. First, it meant an increase in the already considerable speed and agility of their cavalry, giving more flexibility to switch positions between rider and foot soldier, allowing them, secondly, to continue fighting dismounted with their carbines. Thirdly, and this made the difference, they were much more restrained in their deployment of the cavalry in its classic function as a shock attack weapon. In the 1860s, after the Civil War and when the American Indian Wars were in their final stages, many of the native tribes were decimated and robbed of their horses. The mass slaughter of horses was an integral part of the war against the native horsemen tribes of the Great Plains. These massacres were aimed at robbing the Native Americans of the very foundations of their existence, and thus their ability to resist. From the Civil War, the Army learnt the lesson that the most effective form of war was total warfare, targeting the enemy's entire society and seeking to destroy its economy. On the night of Thanksgiving, 27th of November, 1868, George Armstrong Custer executed a shock attack on the small Cheyenne community which had survived the Sand Creek Massacre in Colorado 4 years earlier and had resettled by the Washita River in Oklahoma. The almost complete annihilation of the tribe was followed by that of its ponies. With the help of two captive Cheyenne women on horseback, they rounded up the tribe's entire herd, some 900 animals. Initially, they tried to lasso the horses and cut their throats. But in the face of fierce opposition from the captive animals, Custer's soldiers gave up and shot the rest. When Comanche died in 1891, at the grand age of 29, the University of Kansas had his body stuffed by a taxidermist. 2 years later, he was one of the main attractions at the World's Fair in Chicago, appearing alongside survivors of Little Bighorn, including Chief Rain in the Face. After the World's Fair, it was intended that his body would be returned to Fort Riley, where Comanche had spent the 2 last years of his life. But because the taxidermist's bill had not yet been paid, the university kept him and put him in the Natural History Museum, where he remains to this day, partially renovated over the decades, not unlike Lenin in his mausoleum on Red Square. Teacher and student. In the white imagination, the Native Americans are horse riders, often depicted as noble savages. It's hard to picture them without their horses. Like the aristocrats of Europe, the prairie noblemen are at home on horseback. Like their legendary counterparts, the cowboys, the popular perception of the Native Americans is of them fused with their horses in a thoroughly equestrian existence. The Western, that epic genre that sings of the glorious deeds of cowboys and Indians, is a cloak-and-dagger fiction of the movie era, where the Colt is the weapon instead of the dagger. The ubiquity of this image in the white imagination makes it all the more astonishing when we learn that the horse-riding Native Americans were in fact latecomers in the history of the Native Indian tribes, even in the horse-rearing era, and that the use and breeding of horses was far from typical of all the tribes of North America. On the contrary, the Eastern Woodland Indians, and also the tribes of the Midwest and the South, did not have horses, and neither did they adopt them later on, as other tribes did. They hunted on foot and trod the warpath as infantrymen. Even the tribes who did at some point discover horses and learn to use them did not by themselves become wild horseback warriors. Only a small part of the total tribal population learned to fight on horseback. Even the famous Apache, the glorious Winnetou tribe, only rode up to the point of engaging the enemy. They dismounted to fight the battle itself. The same phenomenon can be found at different times and in different cultures. Not every population that learns to ride necessarily goes on to become a nation of cavalrymen. This historic role is reserved for those who from the outset were tutored in the school of the great outdoors, the hunters and nomads of the steppe, the desert, and the prairie. For about 10,000 years, from the end of the Pleistocene epoch, America was a continent without horses. The loss of many species of megafauna, including mammoths, camels, and lions, as well as horses, from the American mainland is today thought to have been caused primarily by changes to the climate and the vegetation, and not least by overhunting, or overkill, by the Paleo-Americans, the Clovis culture. Another tenacious theory is that of a meteorite strike unleashing a mini ice age which caused the mass extinction. Whatever the reason, America was a continent without horses when the Spanish conquistadors introduced them at the end of 15th century as domestic animals, thus setting in motion some of the most amazing dynamics of modern history, both in zoological and anthropological terms. The Spaniards were experienced and skillful importers. It was not just a first-class product they were introducing in the form of the Ibero-Arabian horse. They also possessed a considerable amount of associated cultural knowledge. From their former masters, the Moors, they had adopted not only horses themselves, but also the related culture and the jineta riding style, known as a la jineta or a la jineta. They came from the most highly developed equestrian civilization of the Western world, where the cultivation and breeding of horses, and all the knowledge that goes with it, were no longer the exclusive privilege of the nobility. The Spanish horse, the best in Europe at that time, emerged from crossing the fast and resilient Iberian horse with the Arabian breeds, which came with the Moors from North Africa. Their horses lent the Spanish military superiority over their indigenous foes, and allowed them to rapidly whisk away their booty, particularly precious metals, as well as paving the way for the large-scale cattle ranches that became typical of colonial America. The horses had a hard time of it with their new mission. First of all, very few even survived the passage by sea. The windless zones between the trade winds and westerly winds were called the horse latitudes because of the countless horses that perished in the heat and were thrown overboard. If they did survive the journey, many died shortly after reaching the hot and humid climate on the islands off the coast of Mexico. Their situation improved when the Spaniards on the Mexican mainland continued to penetrate towards the north and the animals were able to acclimatize. Between 1530 and 1550, there was the first explosive increase in the population of horses in North America. The first large herd of horses reached New Mexico with Juan de Oñate in 1598. The Spaniards had little trouble initially with the Pueblo Indians, who learned to look after the Spaniards' horses without showing any particular interest in them. This was not the case with the Apaches, who lived in the same region. They stole the Spanish horses and learned to ride by imitating the incomers, including adopting the Spanish custom of mounting the horse from the right. From the middle of the 17th century, according to Spanish sources, the new Apache riders had made life difficult for their former teachers. They attacked their settlements in New Mexico, not even sparing the Pueblo Indian communities, stole their horses, and disappeared from whence they had come in the vastness of the prairies and deserts. Unlike the later Comanche, the Apaches never learned how to breed horses or to fight on horseback. But they were the first Native Americans to undergo a major technological revolution and enrich their arsenal with a weapon that, at that point, no other indigenous tribe had mastered. Speed. The revolt of the Pueblos against the Spaniards in 1680 and their temporary expulsion from New Mexico brought a turning point for the horse culture of North America. When the Pueblo Indians returned to their agriculture and pottery, they abandoned the horses they had traveled with, and a mighty river of horses spilled into the prairies of the Midwest. The animals found similar living conditions to those their Spanish ancestors had known on the high plains of Andalusia, and within a comparatively short time, their population had soared, producing large herds of wild mustangs, which were seized upon by about 30 Indian tribes of the Great Plains, following the example of the Apaches. The so-called Great Horse Dispersal from 1680 resulted in a permanent change to the power structures of North America's geographical center. The process was rapid. While in 1630, no Native American had ever sat on a horse, by around 1700, all the tribes on the plains of Texas were riding horses, and by 1750, even certain tribes of the Canadian plains were hunting bison on horseback. It was not a huge step then, from hunting technique to military tactic. A number of tribes, including the Sioux, Cheyenne, Kiowa, Arapaho, Blackfoot, Cree, and Crow, took horses into battle at some point, with the Comanche the most thorough and successful. They were the undisputed champions in the new war of speed, and over the 18th century, they rose to supremacy among the indigenous tribes of the Southwest, a plague to the Spaniards. Their ownership of horses towards the late 18th century was legendary. The only tribe to truly master the art of breeding and raising horses, the Comanche linked their fate and their economy closely with the life of an animal that until a few decades ago had been unknown to them. Neither was their language unaffected. Their otherwise rather modest vocabulary contained an amazing wealth of adjectives describing every conceivable shade of brown, black, red, beige, and gray, and all shapes and sizes of patches and blazes. For the indigenous tribes of the Great Plains, the period from 1540 to 1880 was the epoch of horse cultivation, as Clark Whistler, a student of Franz Boas and pioneer of research into Native Americans, puts it. For many tribes, the era began later, and for some it ended earlier. It was an era that began with the acquisition and first use of horses, while its end was marked by the extinction of the bison from the territory of one tribe. The latest research dates the beginning of the age of Amerindian horse culture 100 years later, in the mid-17th century. Since the beginning of the 20th century, American anthropologists, first the students of Franz Boas and later researchers associated with Alfred L. Kroeber, have examined in detail the astonishing process by which the tribes of the Great Plains expanded and eventually completely altered their ecological system through the adoption of two items, namely horses and firearms. The Apaches were the first native superpower of the South and Southwest, until they were overtaken by other tribes, militarily and technologically, sending them headlong into insignificance. The development of horses and firearms did not occur simultaneously or in the same place. The horses advanced northwards from the south, from Mexico, while the firearms made their way from east to west. Firearms reached the tribes via the fur trade, and while the Spanish strictly forbade any arms training with the native inhabitants, the British and French gave free rein to hunters and dealers. So it was that two separate cultural patterns existed in isolation for several decades before they finally crossed over and combined. The first phase seen in the South and Southwest was the post-horse and pre-gun phase, while the North and East of the Great Plains initially experienced the post-gun and pre-horse phase. In other words, the plains formed a kind of horse frontier that, from the mid-17th century, edged gradually from south to north, and a gun frontier, which, over the same period, gradually shifted from east to west. By 1800, the two migrating frontiers intersected over an area covering the entire eastern half of the Great Plains. Within this ever-expanding territory, the remaining tribes learned how to manage firearms and horses, and how to trade them as items of economic value. The ascent of the Apaches in the south began around 1650. It was through their direct contact with the Spanish that they learned how to ride, adopting not only the Spanish riding style, but also the Spanish saddles and tack, leather shields, and armor for horses and riders. The Apaches, their newly formed cavalry being militarily far superior to their neighbors' infantry, expanded the area of the prairies under their control further and further to the north, and successfully broadened the sphere of the post-horse, pre-firearm model. However, since they remained only semi-nomadic, like many other tribes, and did not give up their agriculture and partially settled way of life, when their nomadic rivals, especially the Sioux and Comanche, began to outstrip them in terms of riding technique and belligerent tactics, they became the victims of a violent